And what they have specialized in more than any single illicit business is really the monetization of territorial control, which is to say that in all the areas where they are present and have control, every sector of the economy is paying them.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. The Gaetanistas, otherwise known as the Gulf Clan, are Colombia's largest and richest criminal armed group. They formed nearly 20 years ago, but have gained considerable strength since Colombia's landmark 2016 peace agreement with the FARC guerrilla group. Today, the Gulf Clan controls much of Colombia's Atlantic coast and is a key player in drug trafficking and migrant smuggling. All the while, they use coercive tactics to control the population. My guest today, Elizabeth Dickinson, is senior analyst for Colombia at the International Crisis Group and author of a recent report on the Gaetanistas. In our conversation, she explains how this group emerged to become such a potent force in Colombia today. And she explains why the enduring power of the Gaetanistas is upending President Gustavo Petro's efforts to secure a so-called total peace for all of Colombia. As always, feel free to reach out to me at globaldispatches.org if you have suggestions of people I should interview or topics I should cover. I love hearing from you, and I get back to all of you who reach out to me, so don't hesitate. Thank you. Now here is my conversation with Elizabeth Dickinson of the International Crisis Group. So, Elizabeth, can you describe the circumstances in which the Gaetanistas first emerged, I suppose nearly two decades ago?
So this organization, which is also known as the Gulf Clan or Gaetanista Self-Defense Forces, they have a very interesting history because, as a former commander of theirs put it to me, this is the inheritance of past failed demobilizations of former groups in Colombia. So what we have is an organization that was founded by former members of a left-wing guerrilla group called EPL, or the Popular Liberation Army, also members of former right-wing paramilitaries, also people who had links to drug trafficking since the 80s, since the era of Pablo Escobar. This is the key marriage right here, is really the sort of left-wing guerrillas who understood how to relate to populations, the right-wing paramilitaries who perfected and utilized extreme violence to obtain control, and then drug trafficking, which of course is the economic side of this organization. So in 2007 was the official creation of this group. It came out of the right-wing paramilitary demobilization, frustration among certain members of that organization about security, about really a challenging reincorporation process, decided to retake up arms, that the best option for them was to go back to being an armed organization, and they started to build from there. And again, I really want to emphasize that, you know, part of understanding this organization is not seeing them in any one category of armed group, but really as an organization that has learned all the lessons of Colombia's conflict and has the capability to use all the forms of coercion, co-optation, territorial control, and illicit economies in order to grow. And that is who they are today.
And it seems that they gained strength during a time in which the Colombian government was making real efforts to end its nearly 50-year-long civil war with the FARC, which culminated in a 2016 peace agreement. How did this group sort of relate to that peace process and that peace agreement?
So this is a really interesting part of the story, because in 2016, as you mentioned, the Colombian government was close to signing a peace agreement with a monolithic left-wing insurgency, the FARC, which had controlled about 22 to 25% of Colombian territory at the time of demobilization. Around the same time, there was a very extensive police and military campaign against this organization, the Gulf Clan, or the Gaitanistas, that had them really in a very weak position. And so the leader at that time, a person named Otoniel, who is now actually in prison in the United States, approached the former administration of Juan Manuel Santos looking for talks and sought a negotiation that then happened behind the scenes and advanced up to a point and ultimately collapsed because the right balance of incentives and sort of concessions couldn't be found. But what happened after that was really a turning point, because again, you had this left-wing insurgency that had controlled a quarter of Colombian territory, vacate those spaces, vacate the parts of the illicit economy that they had dominated. And I think today we can clearly say that the Gulf Clan has been a winner of that demobilization, that territorially, they are perhaps the singular group that has most effectively filled those spaces. I think there's lots of reasons to explain this. This is an organization that is extremely ambitious, extremely rich, has enormous amounts of resources, and a strategy for controlling territory that is really quite effective. That, you know, I think many of the former areas that were occupied by the FARC today, what you find is a predominant hand of control from the Gulf Clan. And this is particularly case on the Atlantic coast of Colombia.
So they seemingly like opportunistically filled the void that the FARC left, and over the last several years have been kind of gaining strength and making a good deal of money. Can you explain how it is that they're making all this money, that they're becoming such like a wealthy group?
So here again, I think it's key to think back about that history of who this organization is. So, you know, one of their previous ancestral organizations was right-wing paramilitaries. And part of that historic relationship was a very close proximity with parts of the landed elite in Colombia, the economic elite, who preferred to have this group present as opposed to risking the presence of other armed groups, particularly left-wing insurgencies. So when the Gulf Clan emerged in 2007, this was very much a relationship that was rekindled between the landed elite, certain parts of the business community, and this organization, who promised to those individuals who supported them that they would provide stability, control, and protection from these other rebel organizations. So that's sort of the base that we can use to think about their permanence in the region and also their economic base, because this part of the landed elite are paying for services, essentially. They are paying for their protection and have consistently stepped up to financially support or facilitate this group's persistence in the region.
So you have like wealthy industrialists in Colombia who like somehow are supporting this group?
That's exactly right. And it is. It's a portion of the landed elite. These are individuals who had been targeted by leftist insurgencies for decades, for example, to take their land, for kidnapping, high levels of extortion. And what this group promised, what the Gulf Clan promised them is, we'll protect you from that. You pay us sort of a protection tax, and we'll provide security in the region and control and guarantee that groups like the FARC, like the ELN, the other remaining leftist insurgency, don't come into the area. So with that base, the group started to expand from 2007 onward. And what they have specialized in more than any single illicit business is really the monetization of territorial control, which is to say that in all the areas where they are present and have control, every sector of the economy is paying them. So that includes, you know, small business owners, it includes cattle ranchers, it includes palm oil producers, grants on a large scale. It includes multinational mines. According to this organization, from what they told us, their largest source of revenue is actually the tax that multinational mines pay to them in order to operate. So we're talking about legal mines, mines that have licenses that are run by international companies that are paying this organization to operate.
So they've really like maximized the like effectiveness of the protection racket. And again, we're talking mostly about the part of Colombia that borders the Caribbean and near the Venezuelan border.
Correct. That's their stronghold, is on the Caribbean coastline, essentially. And, you know, I think the way to think about them is that they are regulators of the economy. They're a tax authority. They govern in a way that a state might normally govern, by extracting rents from their ability to maintain control. And here's where we get to the big fish, which is drug trafficking. Drug trafficking, the reality is that it's a significant percentage of Colombia's economy, especially in this region. And so at every step of the process, from growing the input crop, the coca, to the refining of the coca, to the gasoline and ammonium that's used to refine it, at every step of the process, this group is getting a cut. And this group is providing services, protection as you transport the product, protection as you move the product out to sea to sell it to the international buyers. This is an enormous amount of income that security sources told us is estimated about $3.3 billion a year from drug trafficking.
Wow. So they make all this money from all the sources you just described, and they also are able to effectively control the population in certain territories. What are like the means and mechanisms that they use to control the population, to suppress potential dissent, say?
I think first to understand sort of why this group is interested in controlling the population. I think this is another lesson learned perversely in the length of Colombia's many decades old conflict. You know, when your interests are economic and local and fundamentally about controlling routes, controlling sources of income, you realize that, and this group certainly has realized, that it is, if anything, counterproductive to seek conflict with the state. That clashing with the armed forces can only be a losing proposition. But the most effective way, the most efficient way, and the lowest cost way to control territory is to control the population. So this has been the new sort of formula that not just this group, but really all armed and criminal groups in Colombia are utilizing today, is to dominate and essentially silence the civilian population into accepting and facilitating their presence. So this group, again, you know, has learned a lot from the past conflict. They've learned that, again, an efficiency innovation is to enter not necessarily with mass displays of violence, but in fact with promises. So what we hear from communities is that when this group enters their area, they come in the words of one community leader, he told me, they come in with a mask on. They are coming offering services. They say they'll pave the roads, they'll provide electricity for the schools, they'll fix up the buildings, they'll support gifts for children at Christmas. And they do all those things. They do all those things in such an effective way that the threat of violence is sort of an accessory to that strategy. And it is utilized, especially against particularly community or social leaders who resist their presence. They would be targeted with threats, told to leave, or even direct violence to send a message about who's in control. But this group provides services to the population, and even more effectively, and this I think also helps explain their permanence and expansion, is they recruit and pay salaries. Salaries that are better than minimum wage for entry-level fighters, and salaries that for mid and upper level commanders, we're talking about salaries higher than a Colombian congressman would earn. So enormous incentives for the population to not only facilitate and accept the presence of this organization, but even to join it on some level. And, you know, you see today that really recruitment isn't even the word for what's happening in today in areas controlled by this group, because you have young people lined up waiting to join. It's the only economic opportunity available in many of these rural areas. And the narrative that's sold to many young people is that this is a chance to get yourself ahead, have some power in the community, make a difference. And that is very effective.
I mean, as you describe it, it sounds almost like they're a quasi-government in areas that they control, providing services and the like. But do they see themselves more broadly as political actors in Colombian national politics?
They absolutely govern. And here is, I want to mention, because it's so much on the mind, I think, of US listeners, is the issue of migration. The Gulf Clan, or the Gaitanistas, they're the group that controls the Darien Gap, through which hundreds of thousands of migrants are passing each year. And here again, what they're doing is governing. They're governing by regulating which boat companies can send migrants along which route, which guides are able to send migrants, how much each migrant must pay, what time they're going to leave, in which direction, what route is preferred. And so again, providing sort of security along the route as well.
Just to stop you there, the Darien Gap is that small slither in southern Panama that mostly Venezuelan migrants, though not exclusively, use to eventually reach the United States. But first, they got to take a boat from Colombia to Panama.
There's a part that's in Colombia as well that they cross by foot. So you take a boat essentially halfway through the Colombian side, then cross a significant portion of forest to the Panamanian border, which is where the guides that have the protection of the Gaitanistas would be, leaving you then in the hands of Panamanian guides. And very interesting, here's where we get into really difficult sort of moral conundrums. Because the Gulf Clan controls this area with such an iron grip, security, quote unquote, things like petty theft, is actually pretty okay, especially compared to the Panamanian side of the border, where we hear significantly more reports of things like mass robbery and gender-based violence. But to get back to your question about how this group perceives itself, I think they see themselves as governing. And I think the challenge that they now pose to Colombia is, you know, this is a country that has a long history of negotiating and sitting down with left-wing rebel movements. And that has created some legal categories and frankly, some categories in public opinion that today are being challenged. You know, to be considered a political organization in Colombian history has meant being a left-wing rebellion. This is not a left-wing rebellion. This is very much a all-in armed group, military, governing, criminal, the whole package. They have policies about land. They have policies about movement. They are essentially a tax authority. And their message to the Colombian government has been, how is that not political? Of course they have politics because they govern. And it's a slice of Colombia that's very significant. We're talking about roughly a third of Colombia that has presence of this group.
So Colombia, for the first time ever, has a left-wing president, Gustavo Petro, and one of his campaign platforms and policies is this idea of total peace, right? In which he's seeking to make peace deals with the holdouts from that 2016 deal. And I think the upshot of your report from the crisis group is that the strength and growing strength of the Gaitanistas is really upending that strategy.
This group has really emerged as a spoiler in that strategy. And, you know, one of the reasons that the Petro administration has not opened talks with this group yet is precisely because of what I just mentioned, the history of talking to leftist insurgencies and a bit of public resistance and frankly also legal frustration in finding a pathway to talk to groups that are not left-wing rebellions or insurgencies. So right now, this group is outside the process. And what does that mean? So I'm going to give you an example from the conflict today to help understand why this matters. Today, the ELN, which is the largest remaining leftist insurgency, National Liberation Army, historic, founded around the same time as the FARC, in negotiations with the government. In many of their strongholds today, as I'm talking about along the Pacific coast in a place called Chocó, along Colombia's most important river, the Magdalena Medio, this group is facing an enormous military threat, not from the state, but from the Gulf Clan. So the ELN today is strategically threatened by the Gaitanistas. So they're sitting in negotiations with the government, and they're thinking to themselves, if we lay down arms, it's not going to be the state that takes over. It's going to be the Gaitanistas or the Gulf Clan. They're going to enter these areas, which has really put a lid, sort of a limit on how far talks can advance.
So the sort of fact that the Gaitanistas, the Gulf Clan, are so strong today and that they are outside any peace process is really undermining one of the other most important peace processes happening between the government and the ELN.
And we know this not just from sort of the territorial picture on the ground, which is absolutely the case, but also because in every single round of negotiations that the ELN and the Colombian government have had, this issue has been at the forefront of the ELN's minds, demanding that the military step in and sort of protect them from the Gaitanistas. It's very clearly an impediment to their being able to consider any sort of pathway towards an end of conflict.
So what are some key recommendations going forward? Like, what can the government do to potentially engage the Gulf Clan in a meaningful way?
So since the beginning of the administration, the Gulf Clan has expressed a lot of enthusiasm about negotiations. They say that they're ready to sit down, that they're open to sitting down. And I think the challenges have been legal. They've also been logistical, and they've been issues of trust. We don't have any trust between the two sides that they're sitting down at the table in good faith. So I think what's the pathway forward here? I think we have to be clear about a few things. First, the approach to this group has to include dialogue, but it cannot only include dialogue. As we discussed with their sort of illicit economies, this group is doing quite well. It feels absolutely no military pressure, or some, increasing actually, but not enough to make them really come to the table knees bent. And they're making an enormous amount of money. So what we cannot negotiate with this group is drug trafficking, is their illicit economies. There is nothing that the Colombian state can offer to this group, at least today, that would make them want to leave their illicit business behind and move towards the legal economy. That's simply a law enforcement challenge. It must remain a law enforcement challenge. And I think there are many ways that the Colombian forces with international support can improve the way that they're combating this organized crime portion of the threat posed by the Gaitanistas. But we have to understand that that's only one of the threats posed by the Gaitanistas. The other one is very much as an actor in Colombia's internal conflict. As we discussed, the threat to the talks with the ELN, and also, frankly, the violence and coercion that they exert against the civilian population. And here is where we need to enter with dialogue. So our recommendations would be to first establish a channel, look for gestures of goodwill, really ask the Gaitanistas to prove that they have not only the will, but also the capacity to reduce violence, to do things like let Colombian state authorities have access to the Darien Gap so that they can help monitor and improve the situation of human rights for migrants. Stop threatening social leaders. Stop restricting the movement of communities. You know, when you visit a community under Gulf Clan control, one of the things that's quite common to hear is in order to transit the river or go out and fish or leave the area for a certain amount of time, you have to ask permission. Those are the kind of things that we need to start negotiating with this group to reduce the level of coercive control that they have over the civilian population. Now, what are the Gulf Clan's incentives to do that? I think the first one is really a question of historical legitimacy. This is an organization that now is more than 15 years old, has a history in organizations, armed organizations that are even older than that. They clearly have governance, they have policies, and I think there is sort of an issue of pride of why they haven't been considered important enough to be included in the negotiations, to be seen really as the actor in the internal armed conflict that, frankly, from what we've seen on the ground, they are. So that's, I think, a first incentive. A second incentive is that there really is interest that we've, I think, heard firsthand from senior level members of the organization, particularly to trade confessions, truth-telling, sort of an opening up about the past in return for reduced penal sentences. So obviously that formula is going to have to be worked out by Congress. It will have to prioritize sort of victims' rights and ensure that whatever compromise is reached is acceptable to the many civilians who have suffered during this conflict. But I think there is a pathway forward there. And then finally, you know, there are many young people who have entered this group in recent years who I think have done so not fully understanding what they're getting into. Young men and women who are 18 to 24, let's say, who entered with the promise of a salary, of building their life, and have discovered quite a different and far more violent reality. And I think you could offer them an off-ramp, and many of them would be very keen to take it, return to their families, their communities, and reintegrate into civilian life.
Looking ahead, are there any opportunities or any key moments that you foresee might be a point at which some of those recommendations you just offered could begin to move forward? Are there any key inflection points, key moments in the few months, weeks ahead that policy people who are listening to the show might be interested in knowing about?
The key moment is really now. The Petro administration has really 2 years or even less when we factor in the electoral calendar left. That's really a moment when they need to start taking critical decisions about what is achievable in the rest of the administration. And I think clearly the limitations that the Gaitanistas pose to other peace processes are a very important incentive to consider opening a channel with this group. You know, I think the other issues that continue to be extremely pressing and could help us sort of get to a policymaking moment would be first the enormous amount of pressure that Colombia and other countries in the region are facing on the issue of migration. This is the organization, the armed group, that controls the entry point to the migratory route that goes to the United States. And so talking to them, for example, about allowing Colombian migration authorities to have permanent presence in this area, I think is attractive in this context of an electoral year in the United States. I think finally, you know, one of the emerging trends that we've seen in the drug market in Colombia and also the broader Andean region is an increasing amount of cocaine going to Europe. And so European policymakers really for the first time are very seized on this issue of trying to understand how these flows are happening, how they can reduce them, and what are the best ways to ensure that that fight is protective of many of the values that Europe has promoted here in Colombia regarding peace and a reduction of violence against civilians.
Well, Elizabeth, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. This was really great. I will post a link to your report in the show notes of the episode for sure.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's great to talk with you.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.